Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Laurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. In 1984, a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, was bombed and 85 people were killed. An ongoing investigation has produced no determination of who was involved. There had been recurring rumors that somehow the government of Iran was involved. And this week, the New York Times published a story charging that the Iranian government did carry out the killings and that it paid then-president of Argentina, Carlos Menem, $10 million to cover the bombings up. Menem, a president, a Peronist, left the presidency in 1999 after 10 years in power and is now a candidate for that high office again. Earlier this year, he was held under house arrest while an investigation of corruption took place, but no charges were brought against him. Was this bombing a case of international terrorism supported by the host country government? Or is placement of the story about it a political move by the Menem opposition? That's one subject we'll talk about today. And we will also discuss the United States' refusal to contribute $34 million to the United Nations Population Fund because critics here in this country charge that the fund supports a Chinese program that forces women to have abortions. That charge has been investigated and refuted by the State Department, but others in the United States government do not agree. Yesterday, the United States tried to block a United Nations plan to strengthen the UN's 1989 Convention Against Torture of Prison Inmates. The United States supports the convention, but objects that changes in it could open American prisons to inspection by international organizations. The United States was overruled on that by a vote in the UN Economic and Social Council. To discuss these two subjects, we have today in Buenos Aires, Uki Goni, a correspondent for Time magazine and author of The Real Odessa, Smuggling the Nazis into Perón's Argentina, Dan Krishak, managing editor of the Buenos Aires Herald. We have also in Beijing, Xiaowen Lin, director of the English News Department of China Radio International, and in Washington, Jim Loeb, bureau chief of the Interpress Service News Agency. Welcome to all. Let's start with Uki Goni. Former President Menem denies the charges against him and has been threatening to sue the New York Times for its story. What do you think about what's going on there?
Well, I'm sure former President Menem is very upset about that story. I don't think he'll get very far trying to sue the New York Times. The allegations that Iran was involved in this bombing, of course, are quite old, and I think we don't know for sure if Menem was actually received a payoff to suppress that angle, but we certainly know that the investigations have led absolutely nowhere, and there's been so much destruction of evidence and such a mishandling of the case that it really leaves them open to that kind of suspicion.
Dan Krishak, is this a story that has been getting a lot of attention in Buenos Aires?
Yes, it certainly has. We've seen, for the last couple of days, there's been a continual fight about this with Menem's camp charging that his rival in the Peronist Party, current President Eduardo Duhalde, had actually set him up on this, and the government denying that, and other people clamoring for further investigation. But as Uki says, this is not a new revelation, either that Iran was involved or that this particular story is not a new revelation either, because last year some local papers also had broken the story. So it's difficult to see where this could possibly help advance the investigation at all.
I think that what was new about this story, maybe, or at least it seemed this way from this distance, is that the Times got a hold of an Argentinian government document that made these allegations. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. But as I said, that the existence of this witness has been known here in Argentina for at least a year and longer. The testimony that was included was taken in 1998 and 2000. So that story has been going around for some time.
Why do you think it is that it has been 10 years now, I'm sorry, 10 years since the original bombing that that killed 28 people in a synagogue downtown, and I guess 8 years since the Jewish Community Center was bombed, but in all of that time there has been no progress in finding out who was involved?
Well, the bombing 10 years ago is actually the Israeli embassy. That's a very good question. As Uki said at the beginning, neither investigation has gone anywhere. There is currently a trial going on for some of the secondary players in the Amia bombing, but those people were clearly bit players in the whole event. So to get to the actual mastermind of this, I don't think is very likely.
Is there any connection, do you think, between these bombings and other acts of international terrorism that we've seen around the world in recent years?
Well, clearly, U.S. intelligence is looking at it in that context, and other international intelligence agencies are looking at both events in the context of international terrorism. But from what I understand, international intelligence tends to believe that the evidence pointing toward Iran is much stronger in the embassy bombing than in the Amia bombing.
In the embassy bombing, that being the first bombing and not the second one.
That's correct.
Right. Then why is it that New York Times got this story turned around?
Well, that's a good question, and that's been a matter of rampant speculation here, of whether there was actually an attempt to, let's say, set up Menem by using the New York Times correspondent to publish his story. There's also been, oddly enough, or very consistent with the political scene down here, speculation that, in fact, this was an attempt by the U.S. government to discredit Menem. So speculation has been of conspiracies and double dealing have been rampant in the last couple of days.
I would like, yeah.
Please go ahead.
I would like to say, Dan Kreshok is certainly correct about the interpretation that's been given here to that story as part of local political play. But the idea that the New York Times or the correspondent whom I know well and I know he's been working on this story for God a whole lot of months is that he was subject to some kind of political ploy is ridiculous. I mean, he had been working on the story, and the story came out to coincide with the 8th anniversary of the bombing and the fact that that no advances were made in the investigation. Now, the interesting thing in the story, which is probably new, is that it reveals that the links between Iran and Menem, who is a man of Arab descent, went back to before he became president, to the mid-1980s, and that the Iranians, and I know Libya as well, are alleged to have contributed to his campaign funds. And in return, these Arab countries expected Menem to provide them with missiles that Argentina was building at the time. Argentina had a very quite ambitious missile program. And when Menem was elected, he turned his back on the Arabs who financed his campaign and went with the United States, who forced Argentina to close down that missile plant and did not go ahead with those exports. And I know that highly placed Menem officials have told me that Gaddafi, in a meeting with Menem, demanded the delivery of these missiles. And Menem was horribly upset because he knew he could not do that without alienating his relationship with the United States. Now, and this is supposed to be the key for why these bombings were carried out as a revenge against Menem for not carrying out his campaign pledges to these Arab countries. And this, I think this might have been also a test run for September 11. I mean, the fact that they could get away with these two bombings in Argentina on the American continent and get away with them in such a fashion that, the suppression of evidence, et cetera, may have played a part in encouraging the kind of terrorist bombings that we saw in the World Trade Center earlier, the first one, which was not successful, and then, of course, the September 11 attacks.
Yeah, you know, somebody may want to correct me on this, but I don't think that Iran is an Arab country, and I don't think Iranians are Arabs. They are Muslims.
I'm sorry.
That is correct. I would just like to clarify one thing, if I could. I am not. I have total faith and integrity of the New York Times and of this reporter. My point simply was that there's so much speculation, so many rumors going around about this issue and so many other issues here in Argentina, that what has happened is you hear stories like that, and what that does is it makes it impossible to get to any sort of clear definition of what might be true or not, what not might be true. In the case of this New York Times reporter, there has been this sort of speculation, but I have total faith and integrity of the New York Times.
Yeah, what is this story, and to change the subject slightly, what does this story have to say about anti-Semitism in Argentina? Is that still a problem, and is it still a serious problem, or is it now on the wane?
Well, if I could say something about that, it certainly does seem to be a problem. One of Menem's ministers, his Minister of Justice, was forced to resign when it was found that in his youth he'd been a member of a far right-wing, a highly anti-Semitic organization. Our current commander-in-chief of the army has been involved in some very, very scandalous statements he's made that could be interpreted in anti-Semitic fashion. A lawyer who was defending army officials against charges of human rights violations during the 1970s and 1980s dictatorship was found to be also the legal representative of the neo-Nazi party in Argentina, a country that uses a truncated swastika as its party symbol. Mm. So anti-Semitism is a problem. Now, it probably didn't play a part in the actual bombings themselves. I don't think that was a result of Argentine anti-Semitism. But it certainly may have played a part in the obvious unwillingness of the Supreme Court, which was handling the investigation into the Israeli embassy bombing and into the AMIA bombing investigation. It may have played a role in slowing down the investigation.
In fact, what we are seeing now, Argentina has a very large Jewish population. I think it's the world's sixth largest. There are about 250,000 Jews here. And a combination, whether it's anti-Semitism plays a role or not, I don't know. But certainly the economic situation is leading to a situation where Jews are actually returning or going to Israel to get out of Argentina. So that says something about how bad the situation here is in the country, that they are willing to go to a land that is torn by strife as Israel is at this time.
And that's because of the economic situation in Argentina mostly, or do you think it's also because of the social situation?
I believe it's mostly for economic reasons and social reasons. Crime is on the rise, but certainly there must be some lingering concern about whether there's potential, at least, for anti-Semitism.
Okay, before we go to a break, I'd like to hear from each of you what you think Menem's chances are of resuming the presidency. Dan, you go first.
I think he has a reasonably good chance. The reason is that the field is just so divided, both within his own party and among the opposition. The Peronists are the largest party by far. If they manage to stay together and rally behind one candidate, they should win the election without any problem. Now, the question is whether Menem will be that candidate and whether he will be able to keep the party unified. A number of the other candidates have hinted that they would either run outside the party, either before the party goes to primaries, or afterwards possibly launch themselves as a candidate. What is clear is that whoever emerges as the winner of this election, is, at least as things now stand, will not have anything resembling a mandate, and it's in all likelihood we'll have a round of voting and then a second round of voting between the top two winners. So how much support will the winner have? It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. And Uki?
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, Dan is completely right. I mean, Menem is by far the leading contender to win the presidency. And the strange thing is that these charges that came out in the New York Times are more likely actually to increase for Menem than to damage his image, because Menem has been so closely linked to the United States and the kind of free market reforms that have partly responsible for the social situation right now, that this might help him distance himself from the United States and actually increase his chances.
Okay, we have to take a break now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. Before the break, we were talking about Argentina. Now, let's move to a more worldwide stage and talk about the United Nations and the United States' relations with the United Nations. There was a story earlier this week that the United States had withdrawn its agreement to supply $34 million to the UN Population Fund because that fund was supporting forced abortions in China. Jim Loeb, what can you tell us about this? Why did the United States do it?
Well, actually, the contributions are of a voluntary nature. The United States was not assessed a certain amount, and each year Congress determines how much money the United States, if any, will provide to the UNFPA, which is the UN Population Fund. In this case, actually, an agreement was worked out, personally brokered by Secretary of State Powell, between anti-abortion forces in the House and pro-choice internationalist forces who have a strong majority in the Senate and who support UNFPA, whereby it was agreed that Bush could contribute up to $34 million this year to the UN Population Fund. Bush, who's very susceptible to pressure from the Christian right, hesitated to provide that money, asked the State Department to do an investigation into charges that UNFPA was supporting agencies in China that were engaged in coercive abortion or sterilization. State Department came back with a report that absolved UNFPA's responsibility for what coercion does exist in China. It admitted that there was some, and recommended that he contribute up to $34 million to UNFPA. But he pretty much threw that aside, and in a reinterpretation of a 1985 law, decided that UNFPA was ineligible to receive U.S. assistance and cut off all the money.
Xiaowen Lin in Beijing, the charge that China is forcing abortion of some women, is that true? Mr. Lin, are you there? I'm afraid we may have lost Xiaowen Lin, and I'm really sorry for that. We will try to get him back, but let's go on with the program. Jim Loeb, this is seen by some people as a new attempt by the United States to try to establish its control on the international scene and try to go it alone, so to speak, ignoring policies and acts that have been carried out internationally by other people.
No, actually, I think this can be seen in a somewhat different light. That is, I think the politics around UNFPA are specific and have their own history. And while it's certainly true that the predominant forces in the administration will not shed any tears over Washington's decision not to contribute money to UNFPA this year, I think that this was essentially a domestic political decision to please a very important constituency for the White House, which was the Christian right. The antagonism or opposition to U.S. contributions to UNFPA actually date back to the Reagan administration already. And there have been a number of years where the United States essentially zeroed out the account.
So this is, in a sense, not unprecedented, and it can be seen as something a bit different, although not inconsistent with the wider trend that you were talking about of U.S. Disengagement from international organizations and international law.
Mm-hmm. I think we now have Mr. Lin back on the line in Beijing. Mr. Lin, I was asking you before whether or not Chinese government policies are for forced abortion of women in China. What can you tell us about that?
Well, back in the 1980s, there was a change of the government law to encourage the families and especially the childbearing women to choose and a safe lifespan, the number of children they would have. That was a turning point. And since then, in the 1980s, you might recall or you might find cases, but that's not the in conformity with the government line. That might be the case in the early 1970s, but all turned to a change in the late 70s and in the 1988 new law.
So it is no longer the case, although it might have been previously.
I beg your pardon, I didn't catch your quick question.
I say, I just want to make sure that I understood correctly. There might have in the past been this kind of government policy, but this is no longer the policy at the present time.
Well, it was the practice, not the policy, because there was no, there has been no law in the state government that legalize forced abortion or forced sterilization. You can't find anything like that in government practice, in government laws. And the significant change happened in the 1980s, late 80s, because the government changed the practice into self-choice and custom-oriented services. And so you might find inconsistent or malfunction of separate cases in the lower law enforcement level, but it's not the state or provincial or municipal government level, not let alone it's been a law.
Right, and Jim Loeb, this is presumably what the Powell-led State Department discovered.
Well, I think what they did is that they interviewed UNFPA, they interviewed Chinese officials. They found that UNFPA supported various programs, health and population programs, in 32 counties in China. What they found, excuse me,
sure,
was that roughly half of them, there was still some coercive elements that were operating, not necessarily with Beijing's approval, that is, the central government's approval, but that there, for example, were still regulations which effectively penalized families which had, or parents who had more than one children. And they found that this is this is obviously somewhat coercive. But they couldn't find any evidence that UNFPA in any way tolerated any of these practices or these regulations or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Could I jump into it in dispute with that gentleman, please?
Please.
Okay. With me here is a copy of that report by the U.S. State Department sends fact-finding mission of three gentlemen. And in first point, he said, we find no evidence that UNFPA has knowingly supported or participated in the management of a program of coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization in the People's Republic of China. So, actually, the U.S. State Department decision means that the State Department itself doesn't follow the recommendation of the fact-finding mission concluded by the team itself sent. And that gentleman may be referring to the second finding. And actually, I talked to several family planning policy officials, and just now I talked to one of them. He has been working with UNFPA in the first half of this year, And he himself was involved in this implementation of the project, and he accompanied the three American gentlemen to the five provinces that are the five of the 32 provinces, counties, I'm sorry, 32 counties that are implementing with the UNFPA assisted fund. And the gentleman I heard just a moment ago might be referring to a kind of a maintenance fee. Well, in some cases, I heard that in countries there are, in order to encourage a greater birth number of births, some countries award financially to families. But in terms in China, because the situation is different, so there's a huge population here, and those five countries, those we have each year, we have a net increase of the population by childbearing of 10 million people. So that's why in order to discourage families into have too many children, there is a maintenance fee. It's just like that might be the cause for dispute.
Okay,
but
Mr. Lin,
not understanding of China as a sort of policy that forces or ensures
right. Mr. Lin, I'm sorry, we have only a minute left, and I would like to ask Jim Loeb to comment on the feeling that Secretary of State Colin Powell is increasingly at odds with the rest of the Bush administration and may not even finish out his term. What do you think about that, Jim?
Well, I wouldn't speculate about whether or not he's going to finish out his term, but it's been clear for months now that that he has been losing major issue after major issue within the internal policy debates of the administration. He was a strong supporter of UNFPA, and his, you know, as Mr. Lin pointed out, his own delegation came to the same conclusion, but it didn't really make any difference. I think as you mentioned, the situation with the optional protocol on torture, which the United States opposed, the International Criminal Court, and the effort to essentially hold peacekeeping operations hostage to undermining the court, are the most recent examples. He's also apparently lost a policy debate on Iran just in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Jim, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
We are out of time.
I see.
Our guests today have been in Buenos Aires, Uki Goni and Dan Krishak, in Beijing, Xiaowen Lin, and in Washington, Jim Loeb. Our director is Pat Akers and our producer, Mariana DeMaio. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.